So here we are once more into the breach. Going to get a little Shakespeare in there. The Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are heading our way through the rhetoric out there, finding the atoms, the molecules, the way they all put together, and avoiding the black holes of getting sucked into
narrative shards.
Another part of the universe of rhetoric. This is episode 14 of the Rhetorician Files, a little sub theme within the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Dr. Dan, rhetorician / comedian, podcast interviews comedians, converts conservatives, and talks to rhetoricians, which is what the Rhetoric Files, the Rhetorician Files does. By the way, I've got a new book came out last week, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. I try to lay out all the software programs available to you should you want to persuade other human beings. Check that out. And we are back once again with Dr. David Payne. And this week is, we've titled Breaking Bad. This is the Breaking Bad episode. One of the things I like about rhetoric most, that I enjoyed most about it when I was learning about it, was that you get to pretty much apply rhetorical principles of building best messages well, or important messages, to anything. So you can invade anybody's space in the academic universe. You can go anywhere you want. And I've always enjoyed deconstructing or criticizing films and TV and stories. So that's kind of what this is today. We're going to turn Breaking Bad into a bit of a rhetorical biology lab frog and do what we do, break it apart.
Well, you know, it's right there in Aristotle in the Poetics, where it comes to the topic of the speeches in a play and drama. And he says, go see the rhetoric. It's all there. There's no difference in the rules for writing speeches in the plays than there were for writing the politics. So.
Yeah. And I used to have when I taught public speaking, I collected a bunch of speeches from movies. There's some classic ones like The Verdict. Paul Newman does a nice little speech end. And you mentioned this before in The Big Chill, the opening oration with the preacher.
The eulogy, sure.
Yeah, musing about what happened to our
host. I was like Jimmy Stewart talking to the council in It's a Wonderful Life when he lays out the reason why his dad spent his life building the savings and loan.
Yeah.
It's a great speech.
I always wanted that movie to be renamed It's a Mediocre Life at Best. He never got anywhere. He never got out. He got stuck with a bunch of kids and a bunch of people who, were ready
for it. Well, it's the flip side of the eulogy in The Big Chill. I mean, he learns to be happy with, living a good life and improving the people around him and uplifting them and loving his children. So you're working both sides of that street.
Yeah, I was thinking about it this morning at the gym. The different,
it's an okay life, right?
The different grooves that you're offered, in modern life to try to excavate some meaning, to try to feel something. And that parenting groove, in that small town groove, like he had the friends and the relationship. You see people trying to glean stuff out of that. And does it give you enough in order to, get up every day and keep going back?
Well, I don't want to move us too quickly, but that's a pretty good transition to the motivational framework of Walter White when it comes down to it, right? There's a guy with brilliant talent who's the brass ring passing by. He's teaching high school to students who don't care. His slacker students are making fun of him because he's working at the car wash after school to feed his family before he breaks bad.
I watched the first episode again too, and I've watched that series 3 or 4 times, but I can always rewatch it because it's just so well done narratively and theatrically. But in that first opening scene, I mean, he's basically to me a beta or a cuck American who has to go into and become an alpha. Like he stays beta almost the entire thing. Like he never really is super aggressive. He keeps running into people that are far more aggressive and alpha than he is. And I think that's one of the reasons why he can stay a hero. But even that opening scene, his wife nags at him and gives him turkey bacon or vegetarian bacon. His son gives him shit. His high school students give him shit. His boss gives him shit. The glove box on his car falls open. So his car is giving him shit. Like everybody. And so they establish very quickly, like, hey, this is what the American life.
It's not entirely subtle. I rewatched the first episode too, and it begins right on his 50th birthday. So Walt is The series is actually in time in 2000. So he was born in 1958. So he's right on that late boomer, Gen Xer kind of blend, I guess. His wife is trying to produce an erection for his birthday unsuccessfully. But after he kills those two guys and cooks the meth and breaks bad, he's a Superman in bed, and that's the closing scene, right? So it is a masculinizing therapy that he's engaged here.
Yeah, for sure. And again, in rhetoric, we go poach, you know, whatever criticism we want to pull into our world. So you've got that masculinity thing. You've got definitely an American story thing. So let's start with excavating the American story. What?
Yeah, and Western. I mean, it's the Southwest is not incidental there, I think. And,
yeah. So we have a lot of stuff.
A lot was written here about it as a Western, and I guess Vince Gilligan, the writer, talked a lot about the influence of Westerns on the story. So anyway, just a footnote there.
Yeah. So let's just dock some of these. We'll come back to the Western one. So start with since you brought up the masculinity themes in here, because they're throughout. I mean, he does, like you said, it's very clear in the opening episode. He can't get an erection. He's not interested in anything. Like, he literally is the sort of, lost sexuality, does not have the virility of a male that he should have, although he's
midlife
got a baby
crisis, coming, sure.
You know. But then by the end, when he takes action and does something masculine, you know, I guess by going out and earning money by being a meth dealer, then he's now sexually proficient again. And that's the American story, right? You gotta
it's an American story. Sure.
So what else you get on masculinity in here? So what are the other males? You have his brother-in-law, Hank.
Definitely Hank is a masculine figure. In fact, Hank is razzing him at the birthday party in the first episode about what a wuss he is. He pulls out the gun that he carries, daily carry. So he's doing all these machismo moves on the crowd there. And says, yeah, well, come along on a ride along with us. He'll, you know, do something interesting. So he's definitely being, put in the shadow there of Hank as a masculine figure, sure.
Yeah, and Hank, if you remember during the series, slowly breaks. Like, he breaks bad too. He breaks away from that masculinity. He can't handle it. Like, when he gets the tortoise blows up in his face, all the horror of trying to maintain that sort of,
well, in his injury, right. And there is this sort of parallel a moment with this, because he's married to the sister, right, where she's also trying to get him up, right, as a way of getting him out of the hospital bed. So yeah, he does have that. And his, I guess he's kind of an Ahab type. His redemption comes in the pursuit of Walter White. That failure to close that deal becomes obsessive for him. So,
yeah. So who else we got that's running around as a masculine figure? I guess the son, but he doesn't really have any sexuality. They don't give him any love interest.
The handicapped son is an interesting choice there. And Pinkman as the young man, I think is not, Gus isn't a pretty interesting character, but most notably in terms of the masculine pantheon there would be Mike, sort of the best bad guy in literature as far as I'm concerned. one thing I was noticing, and I don't know whether to flesh this too quickly, but I think it fits the masculine theme there, is as with all or most of these Westerns and heroic narratives, and the criminal narratives, I think the Sopranos and the Godfather is kind of the text of all of this, is the honor code, right? And right. I think that is a male thing, by and large. And so there is this kind of conflict between law as the rule of society and following honor codes. So even though you may be breaking the law, you still are heroic, and it's still, you know, still the masculine thing to do to follow the honor codes of these various cultures, right? So Mike is very, you know, there's never any doubt that Mike would never rat on anybody. This is not even a question, right? He's thoroughly embodies the, and of course, Gus and his dealings with the cartel, that kind of alternative moral universe is very much in evidence as far as the rules and the hierarchy. And that's all very patriarchal as well.
Yeah, so, Gus kind of moves away, right? I mean, first of all, he was gay. You get that halfway through, and had lost his lover to the cartel. And so he had the revenge motif and the over-revenge, right, of Tito or Tio. I think it was Tio. I mean, when you bring those guys in, you bring the Salamancas in, you get, you know, crazy, what's his name, Salamanca, the first one, Victor, who was just crazy masculinity, like completely sure. unhinged masculinity. Like he beat people up that were his allies, you know, for no reason. And that just sort of unhinged aggression.
Right.
Everywhere.
Right. Sure.
But Gus was controlled, but he was also kind of an unhinged aggression. Like that revenge took over so much for him that it basically is what made him vulnerable.
Well, he also used it to wield authority and order, right? The times when Gus, although he's a very controlled, polite businessman, to establish order, he would do hyper-violent things, right? Cutting the guy's throat in the lab, for instance, to demonstrate that he was in charge. And, you know, there's a bottom line here. So he's a pretty interesting character in that regard.
Yeah. So we've got the men of Breaking Bad. I mean, you still have
Saul. But also the ethic, you know, the ethic about, you know, that each character sort of embodies. And I spent a lot of time, and maybe the only angle I have here to work is about Walt and his relationship to Jesse as a mentorship and why that's, you know, almost the arc of the whole thing in many ways. You know, Jesse comes on as this sort of millennial, you know, I think there is a generational thing, whether those labels are worth much or not, I don't know. But, you know, he's a slacker, he's a slob, he has no direction. He has no ethic, basically. For Jesse, the entire universe is personal. It doesn't have any reference to legality or even any honor code. So I think this is part of the magnetism between the two is that sort of seeing that younger self there and bringing him into the initiation, basically.
Yeah, but it's almost in some ways a faux initiation, right? Jesse never learns the science. He can mimic it. But he never transforms into the competent male. Like Walter White, his whole thing is, and he says it multiple times, I'm just all about the science. As long as I'm working, good, clean work, as long as the work is right, everything else is secondary. And Jesse never gets that.
Sure. Well, there is that kind of moment in the very first, after they do their first cook, or even before, I think, and Jesse said, you want to cook? This is not science. This is art. And then after Walt makes the superior product, he goes, you are a Michelangelo or something, right? So Walt does take kind of artistic authorship, I think, in the product, an ego investment in it. So I don't know what it means that it's just about science. And then there's also the moments at which, you're right, Jesse never learns the science, but at one of the final episodes, Walt says, okay, Jesse, you're as good as I am. You know, you can have your own shop or whatever. Still trying to empower Jesse in some sort of way, whether he really means that or not, I don't know. But
yeah, I never got the sense, like, Jesse was so anti-male. He was so weak and small. And, you know, he kept getting beat up by everything all the way through the series. And the only redemption he ever got was an escape at the end to just get in his El Camino and drive away.
Well, you watch the follow-up on Jesse, right? And interestingly, to me anyway, he turns into Walt, which is that he's scheming and plotting and taking control. And it all happens in a shootout, an old West shootout with the welder guys toward the end there, where they actually do a quick draw. This is not subtle stuff once you start looking at it. And I think that is the maturation of Jesse, right? And then they do a flashback with Jane, the woman that dies of the overdose, where they're talking and there's almost this kind of Forrest Gump moment where a philosophy of life moment there in the denouement where he flashes back to her saying it just her ethic or philosophy was just follow wherever the universe wants to take you. And she says in this conversation, that's a stupid philosophy, right? And rejected that premise entirely. And the replacement for that is, you know, you got to make your choices and work toward an end. So there is that transformation of Jesse to maturity and self-control and asserting himself over against the environment. But you're right. Throughout the whole thing, and we are led to that moment, Jesse doesn't want to kill anybody, right? And even that kind of ultimate parental moment where Jesse's working up the strength to kill the guys that killed the kid on the bike, and Walt intervenes and does the killing for him. And that's the first killing we see Walt do. So you're right. I mean, those trajectories, I guess, just to support what you're saying, Jesse is very slow to mature.
Yeah, it is interesting that they brought him back in El Camino. And like you said, they moved him up to hero status. Like now he.
But it took the entire movie to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely. He doesn't have Walter now. So he's now got to assume all those alpha skills, all the alpha, you know, the ability to kill, the ability to plan, the ability to over scheme other people, to see through the scams and schemes that are coming at him, and all those things that we attribute to this kind of anti-hero that has to, you know, be able to survive.
Well, and once again, and talk about initiation rites and maturation when Gus and Mike decide they can't kill Jesse, so they're going to reclaim him and fix him as an addict. They fake that heroic, right? That heroic moment so Jesse will gain some sense of, that's kind of right out of the tribal playbook, right?
Yeah, a safe heroism.
And I think that, you know, I think that's part of the, you know, the once again, back to these honor codes, these are tribal kinds of ethics and organizations, and there's a bit of a de-evolution from, procedures and laws and ideas of civilization or society that's set in contrast with each other. So,
well, let's jump over to the feminism part of it, the female deconstruction in Breaking Bad, because I think there was some criticism during this show about how flat the female characters were in comparison to the male characters. Because the male characters were doing so much, and all Skyler really ever did was just, you know, kind of whine and nag and passivity and take it and take it and take it and take it. And finally, her big moment was almost a suicide, like walking into the pool because she couldn't take it anymore. So it wasn't a homicide.
Very archetypal symbolism too, the water.
Right. Yeah. And they gave her the white, I think she was in white, wasn't she? Or, you know, some kind of flowing outfit.
Yeah.
And so, what's the story of feminism in here? Because it does really play as a hyper-masculine text.
Well, keep going. I really didn't think about it. Maybe that's against the rules of criticism these days. Because I was so struck with the other components and the genealogy of males there. But you're right. The time that Skylar really throws down is completely in protection of the children. When she pulls a knife on Walt and kicks him out and really puts her foot down, that is certainly one self-determinative moment for her as defense of the children. You're right. That kind of passivity, inability to stand up to this, you know, and her own you know, moral struggle with the legality of what they're doing is interesting. I guess she has her moments with Ted and fixing that situation. So there is a character arc there for sure.
A little bit, yeah. I don't think though, like even, you know, at the end when she's in that final scene when her and Walter meet and basically her entire life is devastated. She's got nothing. She's now a single mom in a horrible location. Everybody hates her. She has nothing. Right. And the last
she's a taxi dispatcher or something.
And the last thing he's got is like, here's a lottery ticket to get you out of the worst part of it, which is going to jail. And that's the only thing she gets. It's like that's a pretty bad outcome for her.
Well, that has the location of Hank's body, I guess, I think the lottery ticket has the GPS coordinates or something.
Yeah, so that she can trade that to not go to jail.
I see, sure. To show that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then the sister is no...
Yeah, and if you wonder what happens to those children, right?
Right, I mean...
We're not supposed to, I think. I worry about that too much, but...
Nobody in his family wins. Like,
yeah,
Hank, you know, is dead. The sister, what's her name? I can't remember the sister's name. She lost her husband and, you know, doesn't know where he is and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So everybody, Gail.
Jane dies. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other one, the Andrea, is that the later one that with the kid Brock?
Yep.
She gets murdered.
Yep.
So, yeah, I'd have to say.
Lydia gets murdered.
This isn't Wonder Woman.
So it's amazing, like when you actually do sort of, I think, yeah, that's kind of what it becomes. Like whenever we were looking at this as a masculine text, and I try to be somewhat aware of this now because I'm so not aware of it. Like almost 45 of my interviewees are middle-aged white guys, but it becomes blaringly obvious. Like, I don't think they really did much. And I saw it like when Mad Men, like when they decided like they got enough criticism, they need to start giving real storylines to the female characters in Mad Men. And it's almost begrudging because it doesn't fit within
hyper-masculine. I have a slightly different take on Mad Men because...
we'll come back to Mad Men in a different...
Yeah, well, the special Mad Men episode which might be worth it. I do think it's a pretty worthy...
I can't think of any females that came out well in Breaking Bad.
Well, for one thing, nobody comes out well in Breaking Bad, right? It is ultimately a tragic text. Everybody is consumed. The only guy that actually holds it together is the vacuum cleaner guy who's so principled with his rules are so rigid. He seems unflinched by any of us, but.
Yeah,
and what his motivation, I mean, he is kind of like a mythic Yoda of some sort. He really has no reality whatsoever. There's no realism to this idea that there's a guy, after he made his first $20 million, why would he even keep doing this, helping criminals escape? There's nothing, yeah.
Right.
He's just sort of a narrative fixture of some sort.
Well, I think that is a good example, too, of like the extreme alpha. Like he's the John Wayne, stoic, silent, doesn't, you know, has his code about what he'll do and what he won't do. But he's doing it, like you said, purposelessly at this point. He doesn't need the money. He doesn't have an attachment to Walter White. He doesn't seem to have emotions about
it. No, he's ultimate honor code. You know, at the very end of El Camino, when he kicks Jesse out for being $1,800 short, And Jesse calls him back and says, I'll bring you the money. And he says, your word is your bond. He says, that's right. My word is my bond. So notice how he could have easily taken Walt's barrel of $80 million or whatever was in the, $11 million in that final barrel, but he doesn't. He charges him $10,000 to play cards with him for an hour. but he doesn't just off this guy who's dying anyway, a criminal, and
But it's a very absurd pastiche masculinity at that point. And I think in some ways you can make a comment about, yeah, this is old school masculinity. This is that 1950s male pre-consciousness of just you do the code dominates, even though it's absurd. And
well, he's like God, no emotions. Who's the perfect manager of a fast food restaurant. But his alter ego is this arch criminal. Cartel figure. So this guy runs a vacuum repair shop, and we see him being very sweet to this old lady who wants to fix her Kirby. But underground, he's right. This highly rule driven stoic figure. Yeah.
All right. So we got some masculinity. We got some gender criticism there. Sure. Pull up your Western stuff. Let's talk about that as sort of genre criticism. I hadn't really thought of it as a Western, but it certainly is a Western.
Yeah, and there is an article that I read, because I recalled that criticism at the time of him as a Western hero. And some of that genre stuff, I think it's all there. I think it's a little heavy-handed and maybe not as productive to pursue in terms of all the different parallels between John Wayne movies and things that are going on. It could well be that Gilligan used a lot of those things. And I guess he himself made comments about that. Yeah, I took that from the end of The Searchers, or I took that from The Shootist, or whatever. That may all well be. Not sure it answers any questions for us. I guess he was really very fond of Clint Eastwood.
Oh, yeah.
And so the text got typed as a kind of spaghetti Western ethic. And you can see that. You can see that, the kind of moral ambiguity of, the good, the bad, and the ugly sort of thing. So I think all of that is there, certainly and then if you look at some of the music, it's certainly laced in there. Some of it in kind of intriguing ways that I'm not sure why, this old Eddie Arnold tune about strolling his baby through the town is playing as Walt goes out to look for the money. But when Walt's coming back for the final battle there, he's playing Marty Robbins' El Paso.
Yeah.
Right. Where if you think about what happens to the guy in the 14 verses of El Paso, he winds up with a deep burning pain in his side, as does Walt. And so those things are all there. What to make of that, I don't know, except back to the idea of a Western hero. And certainly Walt would be a pretty complex, layered, and that's also part of this tension, dialectical tension between law and the honor code of the Old West, right? And that's something that the Western hero carries his morality with him out in the desert alone.
Right.
Right, he has embodied it thoroughly, and he lives that ethic. Sexual renunciation is part of that profile, right? His horse is loyal. Women are pretty auxiliary, right?
And the Western has the narrative advantage of gunfights to settle things cleanly.
Sure,
That you don't have that sort of narrative plot structure where it's all building up to this final, like you said, gun battle between whatever the elements are. And then you know that the hero has won because they've killed off their enemies. And you see this like in Breaking Bad, there's a count. You can go to websites where they count how many people were killed by the basically main character's actions in every action film or TV series. He was responsible ultimately for 201 deaths.
Wow.
Indirectly, like he didn't kill, I think he only killed like maybe 8 people himself.
Directly.
If I can count. But over 200 people died because Walter White went down this path. Now, how do you do that as, and you can see this too, like in the Western, spaghetti western, even when Clint Eastwood is coming back to the town that's hung him, they're all getting shot. Like everybody, even the innocent ones are getting shot around him because he's this force moving through, living his code, doing his thing. But the tangential collateral damage of death around that character is just enormous.
Well, he probably kills at least eight in that final scene with the 50 caliber machine gun in the trunk of the Cadillac, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But you're right. Well, I think that is, I think that's part of what we like actually about most of these stories is the hyper violent action dimension of them.
Well, it's so satisfying when he kills the Nazis in this novel way. Yeah, everybody's like, "Ah, oh, that was a good kill."
Sure, sure. Yeah, we don't like those guys. They stole the money, but and I think that once again, there's that kind of a beast within logic that what is controlling the beast within, and revenge in this case, he says they took my life work. This is not they stole my money. I think you pointed out that when Skyler takes him into the storage compartment and shows him that big pile of money, and sort of says, this is kind of it is symbolic. The money has become a symbol of something. It has nothing to do with spendable cash or saving the family. It is finally the big achievement. And that's how he refers to it at the end, is why he wants revenge on these guys. Not only are they faking his product, which upsets him, of course, as an artist, but they took his life work. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the American, like if we do some cultural digging and laying on of some cultural themes here and go into the American story, the fact that his stack is so huge, like there's no denying the fact that this guy has won in a very difficult, complicated business environment through his own ingenuity and hard work. He has won a stack of
There is that moment upon review, right? The very first few pans of the story in the first episode, where Walt gets up at 5 in the morning and exercises, and then he walks over to the wall and he looks at this little plaque that says, "Part of the research team that led to a Nobel Prize." Right. I mean, this, and then we go, as you pointed out, into this day of utter obscurity and alienation, teaching school and working at the car wash, and anyway, being humiliated by his brother-in-law, and just demasculizing in every possible way, which leads to his breaking bad.
And there are points in even the pilot where they lay small seeds of what he's going to be. So he's clearly, to me, he's much more hero than anti-hero. They paint him, they try to get him over into anti-hero. Maybe it's because Bryan Cranston as an actor, it's so hard to take him as evil. Like I never got over there. And I think maybe that's part of the thing that makes it work so much. But even in the pilot, they give him these little anti-hero seeds of villainous technique. Like his first manipulation of Jesse is to say, we're going to cook. And if you say no, then I'm going to turn you in.
Right
from the very beginning, he did. That's treachery. That's blackmail. That's not treating your partner correctly. Like he started with that. So there was a seed in there. And the first flash of anger he showed was before that with Bogdan. And he just went off and knocked all the air fresheners off. And because he was tired of being made submissive by this guy with the big eyebrows. So there were
this is part of our modern hero, though, and I don't think anti-hero does quite get it. I think that's too easy. These are morally complex, divided characters. They are layered for a reason. But I think you see it in Tony Soprano. You see it in The Godfather. Family is this ultimate value, and that is never for a moment. That still shows up. Despite the fact that he has already confessed that this life work is about himself, about achievement, about vindication, doing something special with his life, I think in the the El Camino. They flashed back to this manufactured scene with Jesse saying, at least you didn't have to wait until you're late in life to do something special. This is after their first cut, right? So all of that being said, and his confession to Skyler when he shows up at the end, it wasn't about the family. It was about me. All of that, we never really lose the that he's doing this, that family is this ultimate value. And the scene where they're going to shoot Hank, and he's offers them his $80 million not to kill Hank because he's family. And now he's a brother-in-law whose only goal in life is to put him in prison.
Right.
Still, Walt is willing to you know, I mean, that's that value is not shaken there. And you know, not to go too far down that path, but Tony Soprano, you know, despite the fact that he's a criminal boss and a sociopathic murderer, he just wants to be a good dad and, you know, and deal with those snotty adolescent children. So, you know, these are not monolithic characters in that regard. So evil is not, and I think that's just something that we, in our, you know, we like in our contemporary literature, just these morally ambiguous critters. And maybe that's a little more realistic. Another kind of footnote to the Western genre, somebody has compared Walt to William Money of the Clint Eastwood Unforgiven, right? Academy Award winner in the early 90s. I used to teach that film. But the same kind of thing. He's given up his life of crime. He's just dirt farming and trying to be a good guy, but one thing leads to another, failure at that and violation by somebody. And all of a sudden his, you know, his heroic bad guy character, right? Has to be vindicated and stuff. We got to vanquish evil. You got to take things into your own hands.
Yeah, I guess it's at a certain level, like the evil has to be, I get dealt with, or it's not satisfying as a narrative either for the audience. Like, I think, again, one of the things Breaking Bad does really well is that it deals with its evil characters. Like even Lydia, the fact that she's dying, you know, finally, and the Nazis got it, and almost everybody deserves
Gus, even though you kind of like Gus, getting him blown into is not a sad moment.
He earned it.
Yeah, he earned it.
He was trying to kill Walter, clearly.
Right.
The only one who didn't earn it was Mike.
That's right. We do feel bad about Mike. That's right.
And I think as you look through that, the only character that Walter killed that had some type of non-justification to it was Mike. Like, he misinterpreted what Mike was doing and he killed him. And that was the moment where you're like, oh, okay, Walter has to die. There's no way to redeem him off that murder. Like every other murder he had, there was some redemption.
He could get off the hook.
But that one, no, you couldn't. He had to suffer for that. I think, like, the heroes have to, do even the heroes have to suffer? Like when they make a big mistake like that? I guess that's a tragedy.
I recall from that in the Shakespearean tragedy, if you kill somebody before the third act, you must die before the fifth act, right?
Yeah, because you've earned it.
So we know, you're right. When Hamlet erroneously kills Polonius, isn't it? The Shakespearean audience knew he was going to die.
Yeah.
Like, he can't somehow survive that. Yeah. That was a mistake, right? That was a mistake. So, yeah.
We'll haul it back over to, since we talked about therapeutics last week, like you talked about the psychology built into this. There's so many psychological themes built into Breaking Bad, but the one I started with was sort of breaking it into, you know, the negative psychology, avoiding dissonance, escaping dissonance, and the positive psychology, going after some type of utopia state where you can be happy and safe and all those things. And Walter talks about this constantly, about the fact that, you know, what's right, what he's trying to do for his family, all these type of things. And psychologically, he's trying to get to a state where he has some type of psychological achievement as a man so that he can avoid all this dissonance life that he's had. And like Gray Matter is the ultimate one, right? That becomes like the biggest failure he's ever had in his life. The fact that he was used by these people. He gave away his birthright. He gave away his American dream, his American success. And if you look at the only, I guess, success that he did hold on to in a way was forcing them to give $10 million to his son and daughter sometime in the future, and engineering a way to make that, to actually deliver, at least to those kids, the American success, which is the
well, it would have been a troubling loose end to me to for him not to be able to get that money too, right? I was worried about that. But you're right. When he's in New Hampshire and he's in the bar listening on TV, and Gretchen and the partner are being interviewed, saying, "Oh, he really had nothing to do with our company. Really, his only contribution was to the name of the company. And other than that, he really didn't do anything at all." And that's when Walt decides to go back, really. That's an intolerable public identity, right?
Yeah.
And of course, we're set up for that standard criminal psychology, right? When the guy brings him the stack of newspapers and immediately digs into it and starts reading, you know, for his own story, right? That's that's kind of a standard component of the old West. Wants to know what his reputation has become. So.
Well, and his victories, if you look at the victories that have been important to Walt, you know, he's had tons of them throughout the range of the series. He keeps beating villains. He keeps making more money. He keeps moving up. He keeps his product good. He becomes the boss, all these things. And he has to have that victory as well. Like
But he keeps losing his family. At every one of those turns, he loses a little more family.
Right. Because in some ways made it work. Like Skyler was such to me, like such an unattractive partner. Like he kept saying, "I've got to keep my family." And then I'm like, why? I mean, it wasn't like she was some type of perfect human being. She was just a very standard kind of housewife character. I'm not sure she earned the kind of devotion that Walter had for her, other than the fact that she would have been another failure if he let that go. His marriage would have been a failure. He would have been a failure as a father. And his avoidance of failure was such a strong theme in everything. He couldn't take any more failure at all. And all of his scenes get driven by that motivation.
I think you're right. And success is the only antidote, right? So.
Yeah, and success is a success.
And there are trade-offs, or we wouldn't have drama and conflict and interest, but yeah.
Well, and that is the big stack success, right? That's the ultimate, right there in front of him, $80 million or whatever it is. He's like, I am now validated. Nobody can take
right.
this
but,
away.
But notice Skyler is not willing to sign on to that, right? She, at that exact moment, standing there with him going, "I don't know what it is you want." He says, "How much is there?" She goes, "I have no earthly idea."
Yeah. Right? Well, he didn't.
I'm not part of the corporate successor. She's happy running the car wash, and protecting her children. This is Skyler. So,
but there should be like an American Maslow's hierarchy of success, because he clearly, that money is at the top. It means he wanted that money, and he gave up everything else. Like, she's sitting there and she's completely listless at that point, right? She has no emotions anymore. She's completely drained by his pursuit of success. And she's like, "Is that enough?" And he's like, you can see, he's like, "Yeah, basically. And now I'll just deal, you know, with the rest of my life. But I did what I had to do to be a success." So everything else after that is kind of denouement. He's like, you're going to watch him die and lose everything. But
you asked about the time I turned Maslow on its head and turned it into the funnel of failure. In a way, that's happening right there, right? That Maslow's hierarchy becomes the slow dripping of success out of the system, right? Well, you neglected the other things that...
When you think of success, especially narratively, I guess, you know, the characters are always chasing success, and they can't get to success until the very end, because that's the narrative structure. I used to, when I taught screenwriting, I would try to explain to people the mainstream American film structure. The genius of it is always the character... at the end, an American story gets, they don't get what they wanted. They get something better. Like that's why it's more satisfying. They kill off all their villains, yada, yada, yada. But they were after this thing, and it's like, I didn't get that, but they got something even more transcendent. Like Forrest Gump, He wanted to not, his ultimate want was not to be mentally dysfunctional. And so at the end, they literally give him a kid with the same name who's the smartest kid in his class. So if you're trying to write screenplays, I just tell people the only way to satisfy mainstream American films now is that the main character gets something even better than what we're pulling for. And so in some way, Walter got there because it was so much money and everything else was pale behind that. Like that was the big prize. He lost everything else, his life, his friendships, his Jesse, everybody. But it's like, right. Hey, he's rich.
But that's part of the tragedy there, I guess. That final scene, you know, where he's vanquished these people who stole his life work and he's going to die. So that struggle is over, but he's hugging the big tank and looking at himself there is kind of a drawing even there, but
I think
he's lost his son, he's lost Jesse,
he cares. It didn't seem like the big win. Again, I'm thinking of sort of psychologically an American story, the big win, and I see people do this all the time. I've got friends that have done the big win in money, like an exit from a tech company or something. And it's almost like they're invulnerable at that point. You can't even point out all the failure around them because they're like, yeah, but I got, look.
Well,
got
our this. Capacity for self-deceit is pretty huge.
Sure.
The first psychological move one makes upon that kind of success is to start inventing all the reasons why morally you deserved it. Right. I have greater talent. I am a better person. That somehow legitimizes that fate selected you for this, right? So,
do you think the title's right? He doesn't break bad. He breaks good. He becomes better than that. Loser, useless, beta, cuck, human.
I was on the border of saying is that this is an inverted world. Success in that world is ultimate failure in the alternative, in the socially endorsed world there, right? So this is the frustration is nobody, his family will not recognize him. His son is saying, why don't you just die? Why don't you just die? The money has no value. The love is gone in the marriage. Even his mentee, Jesse, won't even bother to kill him at the very end and can't get far enough away from him. So I think once again, we are in an inverted set of values, an inverted hierarchy, right? So I think that is in a way kind of the morality of the thing.
Well, I think that's interesting when you sort of set up these two worlds of here's the standard suburban life success. You've got cancer now. If we had better health insurance, people are giving us money. We're trying to, and that if you survive that, the cancer, then you'll have a kind of a family and you'll slowly die over in the suburbs versus the real world, the real male maybe, but the real capitalism of you have to go out there and earn it in a violent environment for you to really be a success. And that's where the real action happens. And if you can't walk out of your safe suburb over into the jungle and survive and thrive, then you are not a success. You've just endured a horrible life and then died of cancer.
Well, but you know, I don't know if you're the president of gray matter and millions of dollars and living that dream. I mean, I think we as underground viewers we would really rather be that guy than Walt, for sure. I think most of us would choose that rather than cooking meth and being successful at it. But I think we want to. I think we're all breaking bad inside. It's kind of and here's the permission and the instruction kit for doing that in your underground cell. So I think there is this over here. Yeah, that world is rigged, right? But only in the legitimate sanctioned interpretations or values of that world is Hank a better guy, and his absolute of enforcing the law. And, you know, in, we're getting that morality thrown at us, even by the wife, who's a kleptomaniac, and somehow, and the children, and Skyler, and, you know, so.
Well, it is that interaction, right, in that liminal space in between the deviant world, the criminal world, and the safe world. Like those two guys, the couple that ran Grey Matter were derided. They were hateful. They were the worst of the worst people because they were, you know, phonies and they'd gotten too much. And, you know, every time they were presented, they were just less and less likable.
But who wants to feel that way about successful yuppies? I mean, let's ask who really is wants to say, oh, that's just a terrible world to be on the team that wins the Nobel Prize and start a company that makes millions and millions of dollars and move into this big, wonderful house.
But on false
premises. Dress like the women at Whole Foods. And
they'd stolen it, right? I mean, it was still false premises. It was a false victory. At least. Walter's victory was a true victory. He had to.
Well, I think that is part of the. If we move outside of these world of texts, where it's intentionally to set up these tensions and alternatives, and confusions, if we move outside of that, I think that is part of the vocabulary that authenticity. There's something terribly inauthentic about that. But I'm pretty suspicious of the ways that's getting used, say, in our political.
Yeah, well, don't you think, though, that
morality plays, right now,
it plays perfectly right back into the MAGA liberal world,
right,
narrative.
Right. Same age group, same frustrations. So, you know, is Trump basically America Breaking Bad? Not you know, despite the fact that he has no credentials for this whatsoever. Right?
But he's at least
but he can be constructed
story.
That way.
Hmm? He's at least playing the character. He's
and that's right.
Taking the role, that is, and nobody that else is taking that
Trump,
role.
Trump is to that character the same way Bryan Cranston is to Walt.
Yeah, he doesn't fit, but everybody wants that character slot filled, and they'll take an inferior filler.
But the motives that are being exorcised by this, the same frustration. I'm stuck in a dead end job. I'm 50 years old. That the game is rigged against me. Look at those do-gooder liberals in their nice clothes and their expensive houses, and all this seething anti-boomer rhetoric around that would make it seem as though everybody born in these years were, you know, somehow inherited that lifestyle, which I quite assure you they didn't. So, at any rate, yeah, I think there is definitely a parallel there. I think, and what we're looking at the years of the show, 2008 to five seasons to 2013, so it almost overlaps perfectly with that movement.
Yeah, and I think it's a great narrative text to center that stuff when you try to explain, because most people I know that are rational thinkers and that don't really do deeper sort of sophisticated breakdown of texts and cultural movements, they have no explanation at all for MAGA. That's it. They say, well, they're just stupid. They've lost their minds. I don't get it. Like, how can you think like that? And I'm like, well, if you look at our stories and the stories that we've been consuming, especially for the last decade since cable has popped up and all the dramas, they're all telling the same story. It's all the glorification of the criminal and the deviant and the strong world, and that you've got to go out and fight to get things. And it's complicated. The heroes are complicated, but we've learned the anti-hero, I think, more right now in this culture than anything I've ever seen. Like almost all of our cultures.
I would also want to throw return the frustrated masculinity into that bundle. Yeah. and look at the 2008 on the downward mobility. I mean, they couldn't have timed this better, really.
Yeah. I had a friend who this is my richest friend, and he's worth, I don't know, multi-millions of whatever. He's been in finance for a long time, but he posted he's starting to post on Instagram. He can't stop himself. He's got tons of money. He's sitting on top of Walter White kind of money, but he can't stop himself now wanting to impose himself on the culture in some way. And so he posted a thing on Instagram about, it was just a little cartoon meme of a professor pointing at something that says, take out loan, pay back loan, you know, and going after the whole paying off student loans thing. And I just sent him a little note. I'm like, hey, very nuanced take. And he won't respond to it. But that clarity of two worlds, clean, you know, clean answer and narrative giving you that, even if Walter White has to fight and fight and fight and fight and fight, he still fights through and gets there. And that's what's ultimately to me satisfying about Breaking Bad. He does win the American story. He loses the family story. He loses all this other stuff, but I think he wins the masculine story of the narcissist ascending to the top and all the bodies are just around him who has got money.
Yeah, I mean, we can call it a tragic tale, but I don't see anybody feeling bad at the end of it, or the catharsis of there's a kind of a cathartic moment when he kills all the skinheads there at the end, but maybe a kind of a sadness but that's also because it's in story world.
Well, I think Jesse escaping and the wildness of his escape was the catharsis.
Sure.
So Walter died. Sure. Walter had to die. But if Jesse had died, I don't think people could have handled it. There was so much pull for that guy psychologically of he's been whipped in so many different ways.
I think that would have been bad. I think he's getting his ass kicked from day one constantly. I mean, just brutalized constantly, right? And I think it's like I said, I kind of went at my viewing this time thinking about our talk with following Jesse rather than Walt. And if you follow Jesse as a character and an object of identification, confused, no place to go, all losses are just personal, right? If it doesn't come in his orbit, what do you do when you make all of this money? What are you struggling with? The hypocrisy of the adult world. I mean, Jesse's maybe the more profound character in some ways.
Well, it's interesting psychologically. They're kind of the same character, right? They're split sides of a psychology. And then Jesse's always getting beat. Always. He's always losing. He loses the entire thing. Even when he wins the money, he loses because he can't, you know, enjoy the money. Whereas Walter's always winning. Even when he temporarily loses or gets, you know, a setback, he almost always wins. And so you have that duality of those guys always together. And I think if they didn't have that, and I've seen this lately, like even in Peaky Blinders, the couple of times when Thomas Shelby got his ass kicked, you know, got his skull fractured and things like that, it bothered me. I'm like, I don't want to see my Superman getting that beat down. But Jesse, you can beat him as much as you want. And it's like, it's just Jesse, man.
Brutalizing your inner child.
Yeah, right?
Jesse is the inner child.
Well, and the innocence and the fact like he is, his self-esteem is very small needs. Like he's Captain Cook at the beginning and he throws chili powder in there and he's got plenty of self-esteem. It's like, yeah, I'm doing great. Yeah. And Walter comes in and is like, you are not even close to having self-esteem and just starts tearing him down. From the very first time, it's like, I knew you wouldn't amount to much, but meth cook, you know, and just went after him. And just, if he couldn't keep him in that non-self-esteem loser space, then I think Walter doesn't earn, in some ways, his constant victories are too much.
Well, you know, Jesse is a very Holden Caulfield kind of character in that children are sacred here. They're doing violence to children is an absolute. That's the only warrant under which he's willing to kill as he goes into that first situation. Other than that, and killing, period. And that's what he, you know, at every turn when he's had to kill or they are responsible for killing, especially the child on the motorbike, right? That's when he's out. So there is a moral bottom line there for him. And of course, Walt is quite the social product, which is that, or the hero product, which is that killing can be justified by.
Right.
Right. These are the warrants. And of course, every Western hero does that for us, right? I always use the Kung Fu example of, he doesn't do violence, but every episode he kicks somebody's face off. The difference is that in every episode, we learn the moral reason to kick somebody's face, right? And then for every John Wayne episode, he's not a killer, but for every, he kills every episode because we learn he needed killing.
And you look at Jesse, the fragility of Jesse how fragile he is. He can take a beating. I'll give him that. He keeps coming back, but he never, ever, ever strikes back in any kind of winning fashion. And even like when him and he finally has sort of detached and goes after and has a fight with Walter when Walter tries to bring him the money. And, you know, he's clearly psychologically out. He's gotten so much alienation, so much suffering. He's not there anymore, but he still doesn't win, you know? And so I think of the fragility of his masculinity and the fact that he never does ascend into the boss position until, like you said, in El Camino at the very end.
Sure, can you say he's in a lot of pain? He's in a lot of pain.
But that's the male story. Like, they always get into a lot of pain and they still win, but he never does.
I think that's right. But that's part of the motivational component of Walter White, is to continue to drag Jesse through this, right? Through his own solutions, through his own formula for success. It's an interesting compact relationship there. It's probably just there for us to wonder about. I don't know that there's any bigger truth, except I think we are to see them as a double character and a generational divide, and ultimately, you know, Jesse does escape that world, and they bother to go back and show him actually achieving manhood in the Walterian terms, in a Western shootout.
Well, it's an interesting note that they're sending to the up and coming generations of, hey, you're probably not going to succeed at this old traditional masculinity because it's too impacted. Like, there's too much power in there. You're just going to get your ass kicked over and over and over again.
It's pretty suspect these days, right?
You know, but your options are, what are your options? Because escape, like when you go up against like MAGA, it's very impacted. It's very strong. It's very not listening. It's very power oriented, very dark, all the villainy and that kind of stuff. The stories that they tell, what do you do? And I see a lot of people not knowing what to do. That's one of the reasons why I like the rhetoric as a more sophisticated tool to kind of get in there a little bit, at least can opener people a little bit, because people have nothing. And so when I teach it to my daughter, to younger people, I'm like, you know, this is something that you don't enact all their masculine, you don't enact all that villainy, all that masculinity, all those defenses. Because if once you enact them, you're dead. You know, you can't get through. So you got to kind of slowly work around their flank, be like, yeah, you know what? I can do a little work on you over here. And maybe that'll open up enough room to have it.
Well, I think there are masculinist issues in this culture. I do think our initiation and rites of passage for young men is an issue. I do think that for young males of this culture, there is no right way to be, and it's a very confusing time. I was kind of joking to myself as you were talking, that this age of these criminal, toxic, masculine characters could never have foreseen the spate of female detectives coming along in culture to convict them of crime. And Hank had been one of these modern female detectives that coming out of Britain is like 10 shows that we've been watching. And Mayor of Eastwick.
I was just watching that, the final episode coming up. And I was like, man, this is such a different way of doing a female, like a mash or a.
Yeah, they don't follow clues. They sort of intuit and they just kind of, you know, are nice to everybody, and eventually the answer emerges or something.
But again, take that versus True Detective. She is going through so much failure, so many bad decisions, so many, you know, all these different things. She is failing like constantly. And I'm like, oh, I think, man, I'm doing this last episode to rescue.
It's cane corn. It really is. It's everything wrong that could go wrong in a life within two episodes has visited that family.
I don't know that one. Yeah. Interesting drama. So let's just sort of finish with sure. You call this Breaking Bad America. Why do you call it that?
Is America Breaking Bad? Yeah. I think was the put in a question form. Well, just, you know, if one wants to move outside of that text and ask how are these motives that are being personified and depicted And certainly there's a caution with that, doing that kind of diagnostic criticism. I think it's quite fun to ask why at this point in time, and how do we take these things? Certainly you can't, you know, there should always be a caution among on any criticism to say there's the causal link, but this, yeah, seeing this in the media caused that to happen out there. You have to have an ecological view of where outside of there do we see these same motives and speeches being given, and so just the idea that somehow I think these same things of failure and frustration and stagnation and achievement and this toxic masculinity are all part of our, you know, sort of, you know, vocabulary right now. So that's all.
Yeah.
And the counter morality, you know, if you look at the kind of the head shaking and finger wagging going on in the last 4 years, but it's against the law. It's against the law. It's against the law. And why isn't that, why doesn't that make people behave differently and value things differently than it is? We are at a culture moment, right? Where, some people are seeing a different code being, you know, being at risk and being exonerated. So I think there's information there. I do think, you know, certainly not everybody's breaking bad, but some people are profiting from the system and some people are not profiting from the system. And this is one kind of dramatic interpretation of, right, how people who are not profiting from the system see the way it is stacked and what the possible responses are. So I do think there is something in that kind of traditional, you know, I hear this is authentic, and the people in, you know, the Democrats and Biden and the Hillarys, they're not authentic. They're manufactured by this system that's keeping me down.
Isn't it weird though that the simulacrum,
talk about inverted worlds. Go ahead.
It's exactly right. The simulacrum can invert things in such intense ways.
We are talking in inverted worlds, period. A drama that sort of characterizes that inversion and at least gives us a glimpse into the coherence of that motivational worldview, I think is instructive. So
when I try to tell people this, it's a little fast for most people to get there theoretically, but if you just take logic out of it and just impose story on all of the politics, you'll be a lot more able to understand or get to a place where you've at least got a understanding where you can be comfortable of why people could believe this, like just the big lie and trying to establish that there's a villain here. Like they don't have a villain right now with Hillary. They had a villain. They gave her a crime that they were able to make stick. She'd been around for a long time. She was vulnerable to certain attacks because of being female and being, you know, elite and all these things. And they can't make that stuff stick on Biden. They need a villain. And once they find a villain, that's when they get dangerous. Once they find a crime and a villainy, then that's when they get dangerous. And that's
the it's systemic liberalism now. Right? Systemic liberalism.
But that's still an abstraction. That's not a concrete villain.
Sure.
Yet.
Well, you know, but wasn't the guy putting his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk and stealing her? Wasn't he Breaking Bad? Wasn't he sure. Feeling that? Wasn't the QAnon shaman, wasn't he Breaking Bad when he stood up with his headdress up? These people were Breaking Bad, right? And feeling good about it. And they still do. Once again, this alternative inverted world. So once again, on the other side going, but that's illegal. That's illegal.
My whole thing was like, quit trying to fight story with logic. That's a bad battle. And this again is the 21 Colosseums thing, is like, if they're telling stories and that's where they're winning, you have to move over to the story Colosseum and win there. So take that guy, the shaman, and retell his story, which they did some, you know, that he's an actor. He, you know, lives with his mom, all this type of stuff, of trying to take control of that character.
Well, and his lawyer trying to blame it. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to blame Trump and all that kind of stuff.
But I want to hear it from the shaman that he's contrite and sees the error of his ways. Hearing it from his lawyers, better call Saul.
Right.
It's not watching. It's better call Saul.
Well, and you know, we didn't really talk about Saul, but
I
watched the whole Better Call Saul series and enjoyed it. It's a trifle compared to Breaking Bad, but Saul's an interesting character because he's the only meta character in there that's completely outside of all of it. And is like, I'm just playing the game. I don't care whether you go over here, or you go over here, you go over here. I move around and play the game. So he's got a meta-ness about him that is just super refreshing as a character because he sees the board. And almost nobody ever does in dramas like this. This is why they don't know what to do. But Saul sees the whole board. He knows what to do everywhere. He doesn't have the power or the kind of masculinity to make it work. He's still at the behest of the alpha males with guns, but he sees the he sees the board.
Well, if we reduce this tension to crime versus law, I mean, he's both, as is Mike, an ex-policeman. We never really learn what the backstory there is. And of course, the DEA agent is another kind of instantiation of that. So we get those, right? There's a crest in each one of them in those divided worlds.
Yeah, and I would say Saul is the rhetorician. He literally goes, hey, I need to make a living in this way. I'll act like this character. I'll make these commercials and I'll play that character.
He makes the worse your case, the better. Absolutely.
I will change my name so I have different ethos. You know, I'll become Jewish lawyer instead of Irish lawyer. All these rhetorician moves, and he's very sophisticated about it, but he has no morals about what game he will play. He just looks at the board and says, oh, this is the script I need, and he delivers the script. And he does it over and over and over again across a bunch of different worlds. So he has no ethics, but he definitely has rhetorician skills.
Yeah, I think it's what works.
When he's talking these guys out of shooting him, or when they, you know, he's like, are you the, I thought you were these other guys. I thought I was dead. Like this, just give me a dollar and you can say whatever you want to me. And we're completely safe.
Right.
So that Better Call Rhetorician. That's the actual title of the show.
Better Call Dan.
There you go. So cool. Again, super fun. I like deconstructing texts. We used to do this a lot in class, right? This was the thing. You love to bring up movies and...
Well, find things that everybody had read. A long time ago, I gave up on literature, right?
Yeah, there's no hope for literature. But TV and things like that, yeah. Even my kids go back and watch all these texts. So there's actual cultural literacy here of
absolutely
Breaking Bad. They won't watch The Sopranos, it's too slow, but Breaking Bad, they all know, and Game of Thrones and all those kind of
they're
things.
Too young for The Sopranos. Yeah,
I don't know. There's something about The Sopranos that does feel kind of 80s. And the guy, David Chase, who created Sopranos, was on Northern Exposure and a bunch of other shows like that. And I listened to him talk once at the Austin Film Festival. And great storyteller, great writers, and all those things. Like the core of their writing staff has driven every great drama that you know and just moved around on the staffs. Robin and somebody Green, I can't remember their name, Mitchell, I think Green or Burgess. But he was talking about it. And he does have an 80s aesthetic from like Northern Exposure and maybe 90s at least. And you can feel it a little bit. It's a little draggy compared to like Breaking Bad, which has a very strong, I think, modern aesthetic. It moves fast. Stories have a lot going on.
Well, back to Jesse being maybe a more central object of this drama than we think. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no, I guess Christopher is kind of the Jesse in The Sopranos, but not really. Not the same kind of opposite of Tony. All right. Well, we'll talk about Sopranos sometime in the future. Breaking Bad, that's the Breaking Bad episode. We've broke good on the Breaking Bad episode. And
we broke it out anyway.
Broke it out. It's broken. One more. We will see you again next time on Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there. Persuade. It's fun if you do it well.